Yeah, thanks very much, Lawrence. Thanks for having me back here to speak again. Today I'm going to talk about the debt market, surprisingly, but I'm going to talk about the current state of play as well as go back over the past 100 years or so and talk about some developments over the past century. But I'll start off with today. This time last year, debt markets globally weren't in that great a shape, but the local market wasn't faring too badly. A year on, global debt markets are clearly in a much better position. Issuance is strong across most parts of the market, spreads are considerably lower, and the absolute level of yields are very low by historical standards. The market's assessment of the likelihood of extreme outcomes has declined. The risks in Europe are still clearly negative, but in China, the US, and the rest of Asia, the risks are much more balanced, and one can even think of upside surprises. So Australia's financial markets have been influenced by these global factors. At the same time, the domestic markets have benefited from strong international demand for Aussie dollar assets. Local issuers continue to be viewed favourably by offshore investors looking to diversify their credit exposures. So let me start with my first very long-run graph. So here's 100 years of CGS yields. So as you can see at the end there, notwithstanding the bit of a sell-off in the last few days, the Commonwealth government can basically borrow the cheapest it's ever been able to borrow since. So yields are around their post-Federation lows, and spreads and if you think about the semi-sector, spreads are also been moving in a fairly tight range, and the state governments are also able to borrow about as cheaply as they've ever been able to borrow in their history, notwithstanding the odd ratings downgrade every once in a while. So demand, let me just show a graph which gets a bit of attention. So this is the holdings of CGS and semis by offshore investors. So as you can see, demand for CGS remains strong from offshore. The share of foreign ownership has come off its peak in the last couple of quarters, but that's mostly as buying hasn't kept pace with issuance. So there's still been net purchases of CGS over the last few quarters, just not in line with the pace of issuance. So while there have been reports of some Japanese investors selling, in large part because of the high level of the Aussie yen, these sales have been more than compensated for by increased purchases by other investors. If you look at the foreign ownership of semis, it's remained relatively constant. Again, there's still been, broadly speaking, net purchases. It's just not necessarily in line with the pace of issuance. So you can see the foreign ownership of semis is considerably lowered at just under 40%, which mostly reflects the preference that the foreign official sector generally displays for sovereign or highly rated super paper rather than state or provincial debt, and in large part because not many offshore investors actually understand vertical fiscal integration. Not sure many people in this room understand vertical fiscal integration, but which is basically that the Commonwealth does all the taxing and the states do all the spending. So... but not many people outside the country or inside the country understand that, and that partly explains the preference for CGS rather than for semis. Instead, most of that increase in supply from the semi sector we've seen over the past couple of years has been met by demand from domestic bank balance sheets looking to boost their liquid asset holdings. So the domestic banking sector owns a fairly decent chunk of that semi issuance. If I turn to financial institutions, the cost of unsecured wholesale debt has fallen sufficiently to make it economical for them to replace some of their government-guaranteed securities. So what we've got here is the stock of Australian government-guaranteed bank debt. You see it peaking around about the time the guarantee finished back in 2010. And then the bit down the bottom is the buybacks which have been occurring, and particularly, as you can see, in the last 6 months or so. So we put a box out on this in the most recent statement on monetary policy, which goes into why the banks are buying them back. And partly it's because the fee is not paid up front. The fee is paid every month, and so if you buy them back, you don't have to pay the fee anymore. And it's become economic for them to do that over the last while, and so they have been buying it back. So as a result, the contingent liability that the Australian government has from this has fallen more quickly than the maturity profile of the guaranteed securities and currently stands at around $53 billion. So one of the other reasons, besides just the economics working, that the banks have been buying that guaranteed debt back is, I think, partly because of the ability to issue covered bonds which offers investors another AAA product. So you can switch some of these investors who have AAA mandates only out of government guaranteed debt and into covered. In addition to that, the covered bonds have enabled banks to diversify their investor bases and have provided issuers with a wholesale funding source which is less sensitive to risk events than traditional unsecured funding. So after strong issuance in the beginning of 2012, as the banks ramped up their programs, covered bond issuance by Australian banks slowed as the year progressed, in large part reflecting banks' desire to spread out the maturity profile. So as most of you probably know, the banks have an issuance cap as to how much covered they can actually issue. They've utilised around 30% of that issuance cap now. So if you want to spread, you know, given that a lot of these bonds are issued with relatively long maturities, you need to spread out your maturity profile, and hence the pace of covered issuance has slowed some. Spreads on these covered bonds have tightened significantly since the first transaction in late 2011, reflecting not only the general improvement in risk sentiment, but also increased familiarity of the product. So you can see Aussie covered bonds have tightened more than most other covered over the period, and they now price pretty much on top of the Scandis and the Canadian covered bonds, and only slightly above fund brief. So they're now treated pretty much the same as, at least from a price sense, as those issued in other jurisdictions, which have been around for a lot longer. So the general decline in borrowing costs in the second half of of last year has helped entice a number of issuers back to the wholesale market. So if I look at the market across a whole bunch of segments, to the main sections of the Australian bond market, so on the top there, you can see the bank's issuance. This is quarter by quarter between covered and unsecured. Non-financial corporates in the second chunk. Securitisation, which is primarily RMBS, in the third chunk. And then kangaroo issuance at the bottom there. And then, just for a point of reference, that's the average in the sort of years leading up to 2007, the average level of quarterly issuance. So you can see that issuance, and this is only the most recent bar, is the March quarter to date, which we're only just over two-thirds of the way through. So you can see, by and large, it's been a pretty solid quarter of issuance right across the board. So in the unsecured market, banks are basically keeping the stock of their term debt relatively constant. So in the top part there, unsecured issuance by the banks is basically only enough to cover maturities. So that strategy is a result of a number of different considerations, including the relatively subdued growth in balance sheets, so if balance sheets growing about only 3 or 4%. But one dominant cause is the desire to maintain a strong rating with the latent threat of a downgrade if wholesale issuance was to grow too large. I don't know what too large is, but there is apparently some level of wholesale issuance which is too large, which would likely result in a ratings downgrade. And I think this reflects a somewhat misplaced assessment of deposits good, wholesale funding bad. So as a result, banks are currently paying about the same price for three-month TD as they're paying for a five-year wholesale debt issue. So five-year wholesale debt issue versus a three-month TD, one of those apparently is better than the other. One of them apparently is also more stable than the other, even though one has a five-year maturity and the other one has a three-month maturity. Nevertheless, that's the way it is. And so banks have responded to that by keeping the level of wholesale debt roughly constant. But they've taken advantage of the increase in risk appetite by lengthening the tenor of their issuance. So the average tenor of unsecured issuance has been about 5 years since the middle of last year, compared with a little over 4 years since the beginning of the financial crisis. And if you look, that's not including where some of the covered bonds have been issued, which has been at considerably longer maturities. So increasing tenor has also been a feature of other markets. The OFM most obviously has increased the tenor of their issuance over the last few years, particularly over the last year, to take account of demand for securities at sort of particularly long levels of maturity, and also the fact that it's very, very cheap for them to borrow even as far out as 20 years. The securitisation market, as you can see, last year picked up towards the end of last year, but it's generally lagged behind other segments of the debt market. But issuance so far this year in the March quarter has been particularly strong. We're seeing issuance right across the board, from the major banks to the regional banks and to the non-bank sector, and with still more deals yet to be finalised this month. All of the recent issuance has been completed without support from the AOFM due to strong private investor demand. We've seen some of the subordinated tranches sold very readily. And primary market spreads are the tightest level since they've as tight as they've been since 2007. So what we've got here, so every red dot is a primary market issue. The yellow dots are the ones which have got their AOFN in them, and you can see there haven't been any of them since the middle of third quarter of last year. But you also can see the last issue, which is the Westpac and the CBA issues, that red dot there, are as tight as they've been since 2007. So this spread tightening will lower the cost of mortgage lending for small banks and the non-bank lenders who rely on securitisation for a large part of their funding. So it's very much back in the economic range. Conditions have also picked up in the kangaroo market. 10 kangaroo issuers debuted in the market in 2012, and the diversity of issuers was also a notable feature and included some Asian names and non-financial corporates. In particular, we saw some Korean names who hadn't been in the market before, which got plenty of demand out of Korea. So current kangaroo issuance has been supported by the broad-based reduction in spreads, the attractive basis, and foreign investors looking beyond AAA instruments for Australian dollar exposure. It's one of the other features of the kangaroo market over the last 6-9 months has actually been a reasonable chunk of sub-AAA issuance. Foreign investors have been notably active in buying those securities, and particular Asian investors have been very much evident, as I said, particularly buying Asian kangaroo issues. Let me talk briefly about a couple of things we're doing around the local debt market, we the RBA. Firstly, at the moment, we're in the process of signing two-way CSA with all of our swap counterparties. A number of these agreements are actually already operational, including those with the bank's largest counterparty. So we've got about three quarters of our transactions now have CSAs supporting them. And we expect agreements to be in place with all the rest of our counterparties in the next week or two. So this move is in line with best practices in risk management. And as more market participants collateralise their exposure in both directions rather than necessarily one direction, this should also free collateral for the system as a whole and enhance liquidity and the resilience of the Australian derivatives markets. So the other thing I'd like to talk about briefly is late last year, actually just upstairs, I announced new data reporting requirements for repo-eligible RMBS. So the information, what I said then, was that the information we're seeking includes loan level and other transaction-specific data. And it's not only available to us, it will also be available for the investing public more generally. These initiatives are designed to help the bank, from our point of view, is to help us assess the quality of MBS provided as collateral in our market operations, but also from the market as a whole will help improve the transparency of the whole market. For investors, the data will be easier to access, and because the reporting templates that we're putting in place are standardised, investors can better compare the underlying credit characteristics of different deals and also use the data in their own analytics. So the consultation period for the proposed reporting templates that we put out late last year closed at the end of last year, so we've had plenty of feedback on those. We're currently reviewing those and we'll finalise the reporting templates over the next month or so and go back to all those who provided us with feedback, but we'll make the results of that consultation public sometime in the next few weeks. So let me now turn to a much longer run. So this is the Australian bond market over the past century or so. So sort of going back a long, long way. So basically since Federation. So you can see the market has waxed and waned, including by who's actually been issuing. So this is not the government bond market, although the first part is actually mostly by government corporations, though not the governments themselves. Before I get to the long history, let me talk about what's been going on recently. Corporate issuance has also been robust and was particularly strong towards the end of last year, led by some large deals from the mining sector. So the December quarter was the strongest on record for domestic activity, so the largest amount of bond issuance we've seen, with BHP's $1 billion transaction receiving significant interest. So that BHP deal was the largest ever non-credit wrapped transaction in the domestic market by a corporate issuer. So to place that deal in a longer-term context, that got this graph to show how the corporate debtors market has evolved into its present form. So the current, late last year, we published a research paper which looked at the history of the bond market, which is available on our website, and how it's evolved over the past 100 years or so. So I'm just going to summarise some of the main points which come out of that paper. So broadly speaking, trends in bond issuance by Australian corporates can be broken down into three distinct periods, which we've got here. The first, which extended through the first half of the 20th century, saw the peak in the size of the corporate bond market relative to GDP. So the bond market was actually largest relative to GDP back in the 30s. Now, partly that's because in 1933, GDP wasn't doing too well. It just collapsed at the trough of the Great Depression. But nevertheless, the bond market by and large was actually as large back in the 30s as it is today. The period prior to World War II was characterised by significant issuance by government-owned enterprises. So most of that was to fund public work programs. Private investment, on the other hand, was largely financed through internal funding, and the modest private bond issuance that did occur was mostly to fund mining investment. So pretty much the same, you know, December last year, we're back to where we were in the 1930s. Much of it, the private bond issuance, which is the blue stuff back in the 30s, was by corporations that later went on to become BHP. So again, not much has changed over the past 100 years. The bulk of the issuance, as I said, by government-owned corporations took place in the 20s. The proceeds were mostly used to fund public work programs. Half of the bond issuance was actually by the Victorian Water and Sanitation Board. So if you think about the public work projects undertaken here in Sydney, like the building of the Harbour Bridge and the railway system, that was actually mostly funded directly off the government, the New South Wales government's balance sheet, rather than by public trading enterprises. Over the 1930s and 40s, the stock of corporate bonds declined, as you can see there, as governments reallocated resources away from their public trading enterprises to finance war-related expenditure. So at this time, CGS on issuance is going through the roof. By the end of the Second World War, the corporate bond market had shrunk to around 18% of GDP. And as the economy expanded following World War II, the stock of corporate bonds, as you can see, actually remained pretty small as a share of GDP. At the same time, it began to shift towards a larger share of private issuance, in part, again, to fund mining investment, and as corporations looked to source capital from outside the then heavily regulated banking system. But from sometime around about the early 1980s, as financial deregulation is going on, trends change significantly. So, you know, financial deregulation and liberalisation started in the late, or accelerated in the late 1970s, and from the early 1980s saw the banks rely less on deposits and instead turn to the capital markets to fund balance sheet growth. So as we know, bank bond issuance has grown rapidly and banks have become the largest issuers of Australian bonds. Some other notable trends since the early 1980s are, first, the large number of privatisations. So one other thing which has gone on here, obviously, is that public trading enterprises have been privatised, and so the share of that sort of bond issuance has fallen close to zero. The other main development since particularly the early 1990s is the growth of the asset-backed market. Do you think about, so that's on the sort of issuance side. On the other side, on the investor side, compulsory superannuation and increased offshore issuance has caused a shift away from direct holdings by the household sector, towards indirect holdings through super funds and by non-resident investors. Another important development was the abolition of capital controls and the floating of the dollar. So prior to the 1980s, there was a range of constraints on capital flows that were intended to prevent or discourage firms from actually undertaking foreign borrowing. Since these controls were relaxed, banks in particular and other corporations have obtained a significant portion of their funding from offshore bond markets. So since 1986, the stock of bonds issued offshore by Australian residents has actually exceeded the size of the onshore market. Let me go there. So that's the relative size of the onshore and the offshore corporate bond market now, as you can see, considerably more offshore than it is onshore. The liberalisation of the capital account also contributed to the development of the kangaroo bond market. So kangaroo issuance was also encouraged by and contributed to the development of an active cross-currency interest rate swap market in Australia. So having gone through that potted history of the last 100 years or so of the bond market, let me finish with a few thoughts on the current state of the domestic corporate bond market. So there seems to be a fair amount of discussion about the size, liquidity and functioning of the local market. So let me just throw out three questions which I think are worth considering. So the first question which is often asked is the local corporate sector too banked? Does it rely too much on the banks for funding rather than the bond market? And the US is generally what's held up as a comparator here. But in some respects, the US is actually the exception, not the norm. So if you look at the size of the Australian corporate bond market relative to that in Europe and the UK, it's actually about the same. So both of those two sectors, again, rely on the banking sector, or the corporate sector there relies on the banking sector for funding rather than the bond market. That doesn't mean that the local corporate bond market shouldn't be bigger. It's just that it's not unusual, and holding the US out there as a comparator, is somewhat, well, it's not misleading, but as I said, the US is actually more the exception than the rule. And secondly, in many of the recent discussions about the state of the local market, I've been in the room with both issuers and investors. The issuers say that there is not enough demand for their paper. The investors say there is not enough supply. What actually seems to be going on here is that the bid-ask is too wide. It's basically an issue of price. The investors and the issuers seem to have a different idea as to what the market clearing price is. Ironically, most of those same discussions about the state of the corporate bond market are chaired by investment banks, whose mandate, I would have thought, would be to intermediate between issuers and investors. Anyway. Finally, there is a nascent level of activity in developing different means of financing for sub-investment grade corporates other than traditional bank financing. So what you can think of is banks still doing the credit process, but then potentially packaging a pool of sub-investment grade loans into a security that would be attractive to investors. But I think there are a couple of issues around this strategy. First of all, is the margin going to be attractive enough to the investor after the bank has charged for its credit process? So if the bank's doing the credit due diligence, packages these loans, and I said sub-investment grade loans, up into a bond, is there enough margin left to make it attractive to an investor? And one of the issues there, I suppose, is the cost of the banks holding these loans on their own balance sheets and how that's evolving with, particularly, say, under Basel III. The second issue there, I think, is whether the investors, particularly in the super sector, actually have the credit skills to appropriately assess the risk and price of such a product. So the super sector's corporate skills have traditionally been confined to the listed corporate sector. If you're thinking about packaging sub-investment grade loans into a security, is the super sector actually going to have the credit skills to be able to assess that, or do all those skills actually reside in the banking sector? Which again comes back to the issue of price, is that are the banks going to be able to charge for their credit skills, still make it attractive for the super sector, particularly if it's the super sector going to be actually able to work out whether it is a fair price that they've been offered for those securities. Anyway, let me just leave those three questions out there, and maybe some of them will be taken up over the rest of the conference, but I think they're worth a bit of thought if you're thinking about how the corporate bond market might actually develop. So if that tour of the past 100 years of the bond market in Australia, let me finish there, as I said, with a few issues for how the bond market might evolve in the future, and take any questions on the topic that anyone might have.
Guy, from the sounds of things, you don't seem to think that there's any reason for any kind of third party involvement in trying to help the intermediaries do their job, as I suppose you were describing it. supporting and building a deep and liquid corporate bond market has almost been a mantra of the current administration. Without wanting to comment on politics, which I know what you won't do, is there a role that government or regulators or anyone else in the government sector can play to bring those two halves together?
This government has done a number of things to foster the bond market, including things like moving CGS onto the ASX. Making it more accessible for the retail side of things. But I think the institutional side, that's going to either make the market or not. The retail stuff is sort of icing on the cake. And I suppose I'm very willing to believe that the corporate, the domestic bond market could be larger. I said, I was just pointing out that a lot of, I think the fundamentals are actually there for it to be larger, and it's just more, as I said, most of the time the issue comes down to me, seems to me to come down to one in terms of difference in pricing between the issuers and the investors. I mean, a lot of the same investors who say that the price they've been offered for domestic bonds is too low will actually go and buy an offshore bond by the same issuer in the offshore market. So it's not necessarily it's a good or a bad thing. That's why part of the reason why the offshore issuance is considerably larger than the onshore issuance. It's just the way it is. It's not obvious to me there are a lot of impediments in the way of the market growing. As I said, and the other thing I suppose is working out, as I said, the U.S. has held up. You know, the U.S. is roughly 50-50 banked and direct bond raising in terms of corporate financing. But as I said, that's actually more the exception rather than the rule. Our bond market relative to that in some of the other jurisdictions is not all that different.
Hi, Guy. A little off topic, but as we see the central banks begin to unwind the huge amounts of liquidity they're currently putting into markets around the world, what do you see the impact that that will have on both our own market and on global bond markets?
Well, if they're doing that, the world's a happier place, so that's good. Economies are stronger, which probably comes along with better functioning debt markets by and large. So that's that's one development. I'm not sure that I don't think those operations have had a large impact on. They've had an impact on our debt market in terms of stabilising the global macroeconomy, so that's been a good thing. And as I said, if they're removing this... Bernanke said this last week. He said there are two risks to financial stability. One is that the interest rate structure actually begins to rise. The actually bigger risk is that the interest rate structure doesn't begin to rise, which is the economy is still so weak that actually the central banks have to keep on doing what they're doing. And that's actually the larger risk to financial stability than a shift upwards in the global bond structure. So I'd say by and large, if the central banks are actually removing liquidity from the system, one would presume that's actually a good thing, which presumably would also be good for bond markets, notwithstanding some disruption during the repricing. So the alternative is probably worse, almost certainly worse.
Just to send your comments on the retail sector, given that the SMS...
Thanks, Campbell. We've seen the self-managed super sector obviously has grown extremely rapidly over the last few years. Most initially, a fair chunk of that's been allocated to term deposits, and so one might see them now. The question, I suppose, is whether they're going to shift from there into equity or there into debt. And one of the reasons, Michael Barth can probably speak to this better than I, but with the CGS available on the ASX, I think the self-managed super sector is very much a target of that, given that it's a platform with which they're broadly comfortable. So I do think that is... So while I'd say the retail is more the icing... on the cake, I don't think it's probably going to be large enough to be a sort of cornerstone investor all by itself. But as you said, it is potentially a reasonably large source of funds that that is available for corporate to try and tap. And I suppose you have seen over the last year or so, in particular, corporates which have sort of got a strong recognition factor, been able to put together reasonable retail deals. So if it's a name that the household sector actually knows, those sort of issues have been fairly successful. The question is whether, are you going to be able to move down the credit spectrum, and to corporates which the retail sector doesn't necessarily have a large amount of familiarity with. I suppose the other issue which does come up in that is if you want to buy exposure to the sort of sub-investment grade corporate debt sector, that's actually called a deposit. So banks lend to that sector. How do you get exposure to that? You have a deposit or you have a bank security. That's giving you the exposure to the sub-investment grade corporate debt sector. So if I'm a retail investor, that may be a product I'm much more familiar with. Now, whether you get enough return is another matter, but at least at the moment, deposits are giving you a pretty decent rate of return. But that is actually one way that the retail sector can actually pick up an exposure to the sub-investment grade corporate sector is actually by having some exposure to the banking system.
Yeah, thank you. I will come back to the first question that you put about the banked or non-banked corporate sector. I mean, it is true what you are saying regarding the exceptional status of the U.S. What it's interesting to see is how do you see going forward, given the new regulations, do you see the possibility for the corporate sector to stay banked? Because it's one thing looking bankwards. Is it what is the percentage of bank finance vis-a-vis to corporate bond finance? But going forward, in Europe at least, we think that there is only one way to go to have less bank finance reliance. But you seem to suggest that a current balance here is more sustainable even in the post-financial crisis environment.
I'm not sure I necessarily mean it's more sustainable. It seems to me it mostly comes down to an issue of price, which is where it always ends up, by and large. So the question is, yes, it's potentially more costly for the banks to keep some of this stuff on their balance sheet, although not necessarily all that much. But the question is, can they then package those loans up into a security and make it attractive to the investing public at a price which is both, which suits both them and the investor? And that, the cost of intermediation has gone up some, that's certainly true, but whether it's enough to make it attractive to be able to package, as I said, package a bunch of sub-investment-grade corporate loans up into a security and sell them to investor, that basically boils down to an issue of price. And so that's quite conceivable that will happen. As I said, there's some, that possibility is certainly being looked at the moment, and we'll just have to see how that evolves. Yeah, I can toast time for one more question, apparently.
I remember last year you had a part of the growth in deposits.
Yes.
And you seemed rather pleased with that growth at the time, and today you've discussed the area of deposits versus wholesale funding, and you've talked about the merits of price. Is that to say that if we're comparing the safety of one product versus another, you'd be happy to see deposits return to historic levels and ramp up wholesale funding again?
No. I'm not sure I necessarily caught up the chart last year and said this is pleasing. It is what it is, right? There are more deposits in the system than there were. The share of deposits in bank funding is higher now than it was 5 years ago by about 15 percentage points or so. I suppose I was just making the point that at some level, if you think about what the pressure now on banks to raise or to increase their deposit funding is not coming from the regulation. So if you think about the LCR and even the net stable funding ratio, 5-year wholesale funding is much better to meet either of those two than a 3-month TD or a 2-month TD. One rolls off in 5 years, the other one rolls off in 3 months. So it's not necessarily the case. So I don't think that from the regulatory point of view, that's not pushing banks to increase their share of deposits further, necessarily. I think that's more coming from, as I said, it's more coming from a desire, particularly on, that wholesale issuance, from the ratings point of view, that wholesale issuance, it's dangerous. The other thing which I think is ironic in that respect is if you look at that increase in deposits, particularly coming from the corporate sector, a lot of those. So it's the same corporate treasurer buying buying the same exposure to the bank. Now it's called a TD. It used to be called a bank bill. One's wholesale funding, the other's a deposit. But from behaviourally, it's actually the same person making the same decision. They're getting paid a lot more. 3-month TDs pay way through bank bills. So from the corporate treasurer's point of view, it makes perfect sense. So they're getting paid a lot more for that. But actually, if you think about from a sort of financial stability point of view, it's actually the same person making the same decision to provide the same amount of funding to a bank. Just as I said, the product name has just changed. So I suppose the point is, I think at some point, there's a limit to this process. And as I said, if you're paying the same amount for a five-year debt issue as you're paying for a three-month TD, then but you're not willing to tap that five-year bond market because of some concerns about the actual level of wholesale funding, then it doesn't seem to me that that's exactly the right state of affairs. I suppose that's the point I was trying to make.